With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0. Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
Sam Sorbo Show. I'm your host, Sam Sorbo, here on Mojo50.com and also podcast. If you enjoy this show, please share the podcast with your friends. But I've noticed that people are always looking for new sort of things to listen to. And I'm sharing Bill Whittle's podcast with everybody I know right now because I just adore it. It's fantastic. And I thought, gee, why don't I ask people to share my podcast with other people? So if you enjoy the show, if you enjoy my views, which you should, cause I enjoy them. What's not to love? You know, share it with people. We need the truth to get out there, don't we? By the way, I had a friend in New York City, last weekend. I just caught up with them and, she told me that she was out all day putting Trump stickers on rioters' cars. And then she would just sit back and watch the rioters destroy each other's cars. She said, she'd been quarantined so long, she needed a little entertainment. So, and since she had all this time to be creative, she thought that was a good way to go. I'm kidding. That's off a tweet by Lori Hendry. I love that chick. We're going to talk a little bit today about the big fuss about homeschooling. The elites are getting real nervous because there are a lot of parents out there who are saying, I think this fall I'll just keep the child home. Keep the child home. Keep the child safe. And we're going to talk a little bit about the breakdown in our society today, because we are literally our leaders, our elected leaders who have been duly elected, are saying law and order? No, thanks. Who needs it? Let the rioters have their way. It is unbelievable. And before we get to all of that, I've brought on an old friend, somebody who is terribly reliable and wonderful to speak to. Andrew Bostom is going to talk to us. He's a trained internist, also an epidemiologist and a clinical trialist. And so the COVID-19 thing is right in his wheelhouse. And I want to get like the full scoop on all of this from somebody who I trust, frankly. So welcome to the program, Andy. It's good to speak with you again.
Thanks for having me back on, Sam. And your segue about homeschooling really strikes home, because my wife was exercising before she went off to work. You know, she's still in the front. You know, when she goes to clinic, she's got a mask up and everything. And there perhaps I'm saying it is appropriate, but what you drew my attention to was the guidelines for the return of children to school in Connecticut, and I now understand from my neighbor who's an art teacher here in Rhode Island that they're basically going to be the same. And other than kids, you know, K to second grade, they're going to mandate that they wear masks all day long to attend school in the fall.
Yeah.
And you know, what I found so disturbing about that is that you're constantly being told, particularly whatever Trump supporters, conservatives, that we are anti-science, and I'm a proud conservative, but I'm also a rational, scientifically trained person. And when I saw this school plan for Connecticut, and like I said, now I learned it's going to be similar in Rhode Island.
Ages two and up.
Kindergarten to second grade will be exempt in Connecticut. I don't know. I haven't read the guidelines for Rhode Island.
Okay.
But third grade, you know, through high school grad, you know, the senior in high school, they're going to be required to wear masks all day in class. Now, I guess they can take them off when they go outside for lunch.
They don't go outside for lunch. They're chained to their desks. It depends on the guidelines that you read, but some of them are like, you can stand next to your desk, but you will eat lunch at your desk. And you will not be the hallway, basically. Oh, okay. Everything
well,
that else
makes
is
it
off.
Even worse.
Yeah,
Sam.
No,
that
it's terrible.
That makes it even worse, because the point is that there's actually outside, I would say, honestly, outside of the operating room suite itself, perhaps there's no evidence that masks are effective in reducing respiratory infections of any ilk, from influenza to COVID and everything in between.
Don't they reduce transmission?
There's no evidence that they do. This is the whole point. When you actually look at what's amassed in terms of detecting verified infections, there's no evidence that's significant really in the healthcare setting. There's some suggestion, and there's absolutely zero evidence outside the healthcare setting. And this is so it's non-evidence-based medicine. On top of that, we have very hard metrics now from the United States, from the CDC, looking at deaths due to this year's relatively mild, if we can, you know, even understand it, because, you know, all the reporting for seasonal flu went out the window with COVID this year. But there was good reporting before, you know, the COVID outbreak really picked up. This year, through May, there were seven times the numbers of deaths from seasonal influenza versus COVID in kids, newborns to 14-year-olds. I mean, and this is basically the way it's played out across the world, that even seasonal influenza, not really bad past pandemic flus, whether you want to go back to 68, 69, 1957, 58, and God forbid 1918, nothing like that. Seasonal flu this year killed more children in the United States than COVID-19. And so kids are being so penalized. The other piece of information
that
we're getting.
Don't confuse me with the facts.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. And so you have these authoritarians who claim that they have the mantle of fact when they don't. And then they push these draconian policies. The other problem is transmission. So it turns out when case finding studies, when contact tracing studies are done, there was an incredible story in a beautiful part of the world in the French Alps. A Brit somehow contracted COVID, you know, and he was the source of an infection. And so they did, through all the contact tracing of those that were infected, they came across a 9-year-old that was infected through contact tracing and testing. Pretty much asymptomatic, well, mildly symptomatic. They contact traced this 9-year-old further through 140 contacts, and they gave up. They couldn't find a single person that the kid had contaminated, had infected. And that included other children, other adults, different contacts at a ski instructor program, at a school. And, you know, so it turns out that the robust immune system that protects children from getting certainly more severe forms of COVID and maybe even getting it at all, also makes them much less likely to transmit the disease. So they are being so terribly penalized. I mean, Sam, if we hadn't gone through in past the practice of masking children during influenza outbreaks, why on earth would we do it now?
Because it's not about the it's not about the sickness.
Exactly.
That's why.
Exactly.
There. Okay. We've resolved it. We can move on.
No, it's just people have to stand up and so I, you know, and you for many, many other reasons that are just as important and valid and cultural reasons have been a champion of homeschooling. And I would, you know, my kids are, you know, beyond that stage now. They're off to college. But I would absolutely use this as a rationale to homeschool, particularly if an individual citizen went and demanded the state of Rhode Island or the state of Connecticut, please show me your rationale for these policies. I'm reading the guidelines. I don't see any rationale for them. Where are the data to back these, you know, rather harsh guidelines about masking everyone from the third grade and above? Tell me what your evidence is that this must be done.
It's
now, Sam, if they wanted to protect vulnerable teachers, because they exist. My neighbor across the street is you know, close to 70 years old. He's still teaching. And I would say, absolutely. If this man has the option to teach at home and he's uncomfortable, you know, absolutely give them the option. But don't penalize the children. And
so
don't
there's,
reduce
a new,
this.
There's a new sort of morphosis in our culture. And it's funny because I just heard it today from Elizabeth Bartlett or Barthollet, and I'm going to play a little bit of the clip later. And her positioning is, we make laws to protect the minority populations, not minorities per se, but like the minorities in the populations, and that's what the law protects. And I just on the face of it, sort of, I disagreed. Okay, so here we are. We are making a law that applies to everybody. So in Palm Beach County, where I live now in Florida, they just mandated on Tuesday that you must wear a mask at any place of business, in any interaction. You must wear a mask everywhere. It is now mandated.
Right.
I don't know where they come off, but when do we quarantine the healthy? When did we start that?
Exactly. So this is why, when you go back,
when am I responsible? How am I responsible for other people not getting sick? Why is that my responsibility?
Well, that's a very important philosophical point, but an epidemiological point by one of the giants of 20th century epidemiology, Henderson, who was probably more responsible. He was the head of he was the chief of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins University. So he was a heavyweight academic, but he was also a man out in the field and was probably more responsible for smallpox eradication than any other individual. And Henderson wrote exactly about what you're talking about when it comes, and the model is always influenza pandemics. He actually wrote that masking is useless in the face of this, and quarantines should not
that
be
was
imposed
funny. In
certainly
the face
on
of
healthy
this.
People.
Why are you making
puns?
Well,
this is 2006.
Don't make puns.
2006. Yeah. In the face of this, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
2006. He was the lead author of this paper. It was really as part of a collection of articles about bioterrorism. But his point was that in there's no evidence that forcing populations to wear masks does anything about pandemic influenza. And certainly quarantining healthy people is absurd. We protect the vulnerable populations, and look at the proof that we have of how amiss we were in failing to protect the vulnerable. About half the fatalities from COVID are in these long-term care,
of course,
nursing homes facilities,
right?
Which you know, it is difficult to protect them,
but governors mandating that they accept COVID patients into the long-term care,
right? Like Cuomo,
right?
Yeah.
So I
call him now the Nebuchadnezzar of the nursing home, Cuomo. I mean, he has the temerity to be lecturing, you know, Rick DeSantis and Greg Abbott, who to this point have had, again, even in those days, I think it's in the range of 40%, because they're coming from the elder care facilities. But the absolute numbers are so much lower in those states, because they did make some efforts to protect the elderly. It's difficult. It's not easy. Actually, in Georgia, they might have done it the best effort, which was they literally, when the National Guard was activated in the face of all this stuff going on, what was done is that they were assigned to the best of their ability to don, you know, personal protective equipment and sterilize the nursing facilities. That was their job. And I was like, you know, that's a common sense use of the National Guard if you're going to do something like that. So real efforts, you know, were made, but it's still very difficult. They're very frail. And the influenza or something like coronaviruses, both of which are on the cold flu spectrum, you know, about 15 to 30% of colds, particularly colds that kids get, are coronaviruses, which may be one reason they're getting some cross-reactive immunity, because they get them a couple of times a year. And it's been theorized that that's one of the reasons that kids are getting, you know, relatively protected from
COVID-19. If we protect the kids from getting COVID-19, because apparently it doesn't actually affect children nearly as harshly as it affects adults,
Nearly as harshly as the flu, Sam, which they, you know, we try and immunize them, but they get it every year.
Right. So if we protect children from getting it, are we actually damaging their immune response
That's been argued too. Again, the concept of herd immunity is very, very important. In other words, what is the proportion of a population that has to be infected and control the disease and develop an immune response to now prevent the more vulnerable parts of the population that could get a very serious form of the disease from getting it? And this is a concept that's 100 years old, before the vaccination era. And I was shocked when I recently reviewed it. I reviewed it and something for the lay audience was published at Conservative Review. I was shocked to see the original concept of this, because again, this was before mass vaccination, described how the proportion of the population could be very low to confer this protection. Whereas if you start looking in terms of smallpox, which is something that you really do want to try and eradicate because it's got a 30% mortality rate, it's crippling, it's very contagious. That's a vaccine model. So when you look at herd immunity for something like that, you've got to rely on immunization because you need about, at least 2/3 to 90% of the population to be immunized. And so what they're doing now in these discussions of COVID-19 vaccination is they're not applying the original concept of herd immunity. They're applying a vaccine-based eradication model. And that's another problem. There are updated estimates from, serious infectious disease specialists that it may just take 10 to 20% of a population to develop herd immunity.
Can you just walk me through, because I guess I don't quite understand what herd immunity really confers. Like, what does it really mean?
Okay, so what it means is that the person who gets, a mild, sometimes, and we're now seeing this with COVID, completely asymptomatic form of the disease and fends it off and becomes quote unquote immune to it by various mechanisms, different
right.
cellular mechanisms, et cetera.
Right.
That person is not only resistant to another infection, they're not infectious. And see, this is the.
But can I catch that? Can I catch that anti-infection from them? Is that what herd immunity like herd immunity?
No. It's a functional thing, Sam. So in other words, the index person who is now immune is removed from the population of those who can infect others.
Okay.
And that may apply. Really to a strong extent, and the best example may be the most salient example, may be among kids who have such robust immune systems and maybe this past history of being cross-reactively immune from coronaviruses that cause colds, that's why we're seeing them both get, if they get it at all, get a very mild form of the disease and not be the ones that are really conveying it. To me, that's an example of herd immunity. And those are the people you want out circulating in the population. And the other thing is that we should know, and it's, I mean, people don't like to hear this, but we had a severe acute respiratory syndrome that was a coronavirus. It's now called SARS-CoV-1.
SARS, yeah.
In 2002, 2003.
Right.
No successful vaccine. Fast forward 10 years
exactly.
That, Middle East respiratory syndrome, another
right.
coronavirus.
MERS.
No successful vaccine.
The MERS, yeah.
And so, we've been at this for 17 years now with no successful vaccines. Moreover, the thing that caught my attention in reviewing this literature is that, in fact, in animal models, there were vaccines that did what you would like to see it do. They elicited an immune response in the animal. But then the next step is you have to challenge the animal with live virus. Well, when they did that, to some extent, they got less active infection, but they developed this overwhelming immune response, which caused as much damage to the animal's lungs as the virus itself.
Oh my Lord.
Without a vaccine.
Oh.
So this has to be and that's why you have all kinds of safety testing and so it really never got much past that stage with SARS-CoV-1 and MERS. So we now it could be that efforts that are ongoing now will avoid that pitfall. But certainly that's something that you have to bear in mind. The other thing that's going on, if you look at the vaccine researchers, it's sort of morbidly funny, but at Oxford, there's, big clinical trialists, going on, and vaccine development. They're lamenting the fact that the virus is burning out so quickly, particularly in the UK, that they may not have enough cases to test for efficacy of the vaccine. I mean, you have to still have a population of people who are susceptible and will develop COVID-19.
Darn it. We need to get more sick people.
To me, I'm saying, well, good. There's herd immunity again. There's a ski resort in the Austrian Alps where 80% of the people were asymptomatic, but almost 50% of the population has antibody evidence of immunity, and so they probably clearly have herd immunity. And so it just, these things can happen naturally. And that's my point.
Herd immunity is just that you had enough exposure to develop the antibodies, but you didn't actually, for whatever reason, develop the disease. Is that what you're saying?
Basically, and it's not just antibodies, Sam, because there's other functions of the immune. The antibodies are produced by cells that are called B lymphocytes. There's also this very robust immune system that may be even more important that's based on something called T lymphocytes. The antibody testing in the blood, in the serum, only picks up the antibodies. It doesn't pick up this very robust response, which now we know from COVID can be present in people who test negative for the antibodies, and yet they have this other form of immunity that may be at least as robust, if not more robust. So that broadens the spectrum of people that develop immunity to mercifully, non-lethal exposures, non-lethal infections.
Interesting. So my son got tested, and he tested positive for the antibodies.
Yep.
And they do two tests. My understanding, so correct me if I'm wrong, there are two different tests. One of them tests like recent exposure.
Right, and that may be an IgM antibody. Did they explain that to you?
I wasn't there. He was on his own. But basically it's like you currently have it or you've recently fought it off. Maybe you didn't even know. Then the other one is you're already immune. Basically, you developed the antibodies. We don't know when or how, but you just did. It's been a month or more, and you're immune because you're showing the antibodies.
There are phases,
right?
There are phases of responses. So different.
It's amazing that they can even tell that. Date your antibodies or something.
But they know that for example the immunoglobulin M rises first. Immunoglobulin G and A can rise later on. And then there are specific antibodies that are called neutralizing antibodies that are really the ones that do the heavy policing. So some can some immunoglobulin elevations detect exposure and others detect the policing. But that's only one part of the spectrum that's related to this, what I was saying, the B cell function. There's another whole set of responses that are regulated by T cells, which may be at least, if not more important, and they're not even picked up.
They don't know how to test for those yet.
Well, they do in specialized laboratories, but they're not generally applied,
right,
and easy assays to perform in population.
Right. And so that leaves us with recent results have shown that there's a rising number of cases. And everybody's like, oh my gosh, the cases are rising. And my point is, because they're testing more.
Right. Well, a lot of that has to do with a mass increase in testing. There's no question about that. But there are pockets of the country where you're seeing, even if you adjust for the increased volume of testing, the percentage of positive tests is higher. But to me,
can we blame the shutdown?
No,
but I'm not joking. Like, I want to blame the shutdown. I want to say, because you suppressed our immune systems by keeping us home.
Well,
making us wear masks.
Maybe, and you'd be saying now that people are back out again. Maybe, but also there were a lot of infections that were caused by forcing intergenerational family units together, forcing, you know, people, you know, my wife's back and forth to the hospital every day and is, you know, as careful as she can be. You know, we all had symptoms of it. We don't know whether the lockdown did anything. Plus, it turns out that, you know, there was just a very interesting study released in Science, which I had read the preprint a couple of months ago. But basically what these investigators showed by using these CDC data, they surveil influenza-like illnesses. And there was a huge uncharacteristic spike in March. And what these investigators did methodically is show, my God, that's clearly corona. And it translated in just a 3-week period to 8 million infections. So way beyond what we're getting by, you know, just testing symptomatic people and doing the throat swab and finding that there's this little piece of the virus present in their saliva or their secretions.
So translate that to me. What does that actually mean?
Spread like wildfire. It spread like wildfire before the lockdowns is basically what that means. And, you know, many of those infections were completely asymptomatic. Again, getting back to the idea that, yes, if coronaviruses, and by the way, not just COVID-19.
But hold on, then our death rate is off.
Oh, it's way off. Of course it's way off. I'm sorry, but yes. So we also know from CDC, and this is a very conservative estimate. I think it's even lower. But from CDC, what we know, they published this May 20th.
Yeah.
What we they calculated that about anywhere from 35 to 50%, I think it's higher, of the infections were asymptomatic.
Right.
And then you can calculate from that with the known, you know, COVID deaths, which, right, you know, let's honestly, they are exaggerated, but just use their numbers.
Right. Well, hold on, because I don't want to go too fast. The known COVID deaths are exaggerated because so many deaths were attributed to COVID because they are fiscally incentivized to attribute them to COVID at the hospitals.
Particularly the hotspots are overwhelmed to a certain extent. And yes, you're right. They are fiscally incentivized, but it's very difficult even when done, above board completely with no financial incentive consideration, to distinguish someone dying from whether it's influenza or COVID superimposed upon the real critical
like
end-stage heart failure or cancer or something like that.
Run over by a steamroller, died of COVID.
Well, yeah, those cases are even worse. But it really is legitimately difficult sometimes.
We don't have to blame the providers. I'm just saying the numbers are already skewed. So we already have, we know that.
The numbers as they exist, Sam.
CDC are heightened.
CDC did this. So it's a simple calculation.
Right.
What are the number of deaths in the numerator? What are the number of deaths that are attributed to this infection, to COVID-19, versus the total spectrum of infections? And what the CDC, to its credit, did, and again, I think this is still too conservative, is that they said, oh my goodness, well, when you actually look at the range of asymptomatic infections, then the infection fatality ratio dropped to somewhere between 0.2 to 0.27%.
Correct.
And I was struck by the second number, the 0.27%, because that is almost exactly what happened in 1957-58 when we had the pandemic flu that came out of Hong Kong, you know, British controlled Hong Kong. And then we had 6 months to prepare before it actually hit in my state, in Newport, Rhode Island. The Navy brought it and it spread like wildfire. About a quarter of the U.S. population was infected, 57-58. The infection fatality ratio, remember, one end of the CDC estimate is 0.27%. In 1957-58, the infection fatality ratio for this influenza A pandemic was 0.26%. And they actually had the benefit of at least 6 months lag time to develop a vaccine that they tried to apply to children and to the elderly. And so here, in the absence of a vaccine, we're back to something that's about the same. The country in 1957-58 did not lock down. The GDP was barely affected. It was affected a little bit, but barely, within, you know, the normal range of variation of the gross domestic product.
Sure.
And it was just a whole different mindset. And getting back to this guy I mentioned, this Johns Hopkins epidemiologist, the late Henderson, he specifically cited that in this 2006 paper as why you don't lock down. You don't want to damage the economy. If you do the best to protect people and you keep things going, that's critically important. And of course, you do develop herd immunity under
okay.
those circumstances.
I know I'm keeping you too long, but let's talk about the ramifications on the health industry as a whole. We locked down. We prevented people from getting non-essential services, including medical services, right? We prevented
screenings, all kinds of things.
Right, screenings.
Yeah.
We scared people into not going into the hospital when they might have suspected that they had a heart attack. We've had an uptick in the rate of suicide and domestic violence yep. and all of those mm-hmm. things. But what have right. we done to the medical community? Can you comment on that? Because we've had layoffs, right?
Yes. And I hope some of those people are being hired back as hospitals reopen, all kinds of elective procedures are being done. But I don't really know if given the extent of the layoffs, if we're going to recover. And what you're alluding to is the devastation to provision of non-COVID care. And we don't know. We don't know the fallout in terms of mortality and morbidity that this created. I mean, there's been some suggestive studies, preliminary studies about death from stroke and heart attack. There have been some projections about what the impact is going to be in terms of cancer screening, in terms of childhood immunization, things like that. We really don't know. But none of that collateral damage. Looks good. It looks bad. It looks bad. And for all these social justice warriors, of course, the impact of these measures is going to be felt disproportionately in the less developed world. It really is. I mean, there's expected to be very large increases in things like malaria, for example. And maybe preventable diseases. Because all the resources were diverted away, basically. And so you can't do everything at once. And that's really tragic, Sam, because getting back to this idea of an infection fatality ratio, the largest swath of humanity in one country is India. Well, it turns out the end of the first week in June, the Indian Council of Medical Research did some of this antibody testing, like your son had, and they didn't have a huge prevalence of antibody testing, but enough in the major cities, enough to let them calculate this infection fatality ratio for India, a country which runs the gamut, from highly sophisticated, some great healthcare to virtually none.
Right.
And all within the area and the cities that they sampled. And the infection fatality ratio was 0.08%. It was truly in the flu to seasonal flu range. These data should give
Wait,
us
Wait, COVID
pause.
Is less than the flu?
It was right in the seasonal flu range. Not even taking it out of Remember the number I gave you before was 0.26% for the 1957-58.
Oh, that was the pandemic flu.
Pandemic flu. That's right. This was 0.08%. This is much more like, a seasonal flu. It's a little high for that, but it's much more like a seasonal flu. And again, in the absence of any attempt at vaccination.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest population based
and here
country
we are,
in the world.
And we're all, not all of us, but we're all scared. We're wearing masks. I can't stand the masks. I have to say, I feel
horrible.
So
especially
suffocated.
Out of doors, it's
can
terrible.
Can you write me an excuse? Can I get a card that says you can't ask me why, but I'm medically forbidden to wear a mask?
Well, if you apply it really tightly and then get one of these portable pulse oximetry units, which you can put on your finger. And you can demonstrate with the mask on and the mask off, you're actually starting to desaturate a little bit. Maybe that would do the trick.
Mm.
because there have been anecdotal things, you know, headaches and all kinds of other things. But
no, there's a woman who crashed her car because she passed out. She had the mask on while she was driving. I look at people driving and I'm like, somebody needs to pull that idiot over. He's in his freaking car.
Sam, it's funny you should say that because, you know, with all the Amazon deliveries, I mean, at a certain point, you know, my daughter wanted to bake challah for Friday night. We have no flour. I'm ordering flour on Amazon.
Right.
You know, so the guys are driving around. I'm saying to them, look, you know, if the company requires you to wear a mask when you're actually making the delivery drop off, okay, but when you're in your truck by yourself, take the darn thing off. Don't wear it all day.
Right. Right. Don't wear it all day. People don't understand what they're doing to their lungs by forcing their lungs to refilter the pathogens that their lungs have already tried to expel.
Well, but it's also that the masks become a breeding ground.
Of course.
Hands to the mask.
I had to go somewhere and they required a mask and the person I was meeting before we went in, he's like, yeah, they require a mask. So he handed me a mask and he handed it to me in his sweaty hand. Like, here's something that my hand has been all over. Put it now on your face.
I know. I mean, it's tragic what's going on, but there's always comedy in this tragedy. It's nuts. I mean, it's irrational. And that's frightening to me too. We're seeing for all the polemics against conservatives that they're anti-science, these policies are anti-science.
And they're anti-human.
Yes, and they're for control. They're really for control. And I actually believe that the success in terms of imposing this totalitarian control actually inspired these Marxist rioters and destroyers.
They're being encouraged. They're being empowered and encouraged. They took over a part of Seattle and nobody said whoop.
Andy Ngo is reporting now that they're basically attempting to do the same thing in Portland.
He's
a remarkably courageous young man.
He is remarkably courageous. Hat tip to Andy Ngo. Also, when are you running for public office, darling?
Yeah, right. My son just graduated from high school, but I'm seriously considering, my neighbor's going to send me, the guidelines that have been developed for the state of Rhode Island for school. I'm seriously considering, some sort of, lawsuit to challenge them because they're anti-science in terms of, again, the masking of children all day in school. Etc. With no scientific basis whatsoever. There's none.
It's phenomenal. There's no scientific basis. This is so much worse than the emperor's the emperor's new clothes. It's beyond the pale, and it's being imposed on people.
If this whole sort of mindset. Where was it with all every year with these influenza outbreaks, which vary, but some of them have been pretty bad, including, I think, 2017 to early 2018 was a particularly bad one. And now I looked at some stories about the Houston area because, you know, now that's in the news. And Houston during that peak flu season, they were pretty much at the point of setting up, field hospital like things. They weren't called that. The idea of hospital capacity. I mean, when you actually look at the local stories coming out of Houston now, even in the Houston Chronicle, which is no bastion of conservative journalism, the hospital officials are saying, look, we're used to running close to capacity. We have contingency plans in place. We've seen how this virus behaves. We have much better stocks of PPE. We know how to deal with it now, much better than we did several months ago. As if this zero learning curve, and so calm down. I mean, that was basically the message, even in the Houston Chronicle story I read yesterday.
And yet, I heard that the governor there is reconsidering closing down businesses.
I know because they, you know, they really don't know what to do. And obviously, you know, with all due respect to Governor Abbott, he's proven himself not to be a DeSantis who seriously studied this issue, saw it coming from Italy and, you know, prepared his state and prepared his mind to understand what the long haul was going to look like.
You know what? I'll tell you one thing. The reason that we're in this mess is because all of the people that we have elected to public office went to public school. And so they don't understand science. They don't understand
logic. Well, they went to the Ivy League.
And they don't understand logic. And the things that they understand are power, crowd control, and that is why they are all leaning, not all of them, okay? I'm saying all, but obviously it's not everyone to a person, but they're leaning towards the sides of totalitarianism and anti-capitalism.
Oh, yes.
It's because that's what they were taught in school. So if you're well, I don't know, Andy, where you send your daughters to school, but stop it.
Both kids. No, my daughter and my son, they're both going to a sprawling state university. They're in honors programs and they're studying science and they're just not, you know, they've been indoctrinated by me. They haven't been indoctrinated by their schools. So,
well, good. The good news is they can study at home online now. Because all the schools are moving to online, and
their school is wide open for ostensibly starting you know the fall semester.
Well, good. We need more of that to show people what freedom looks like and how much safer it is, right?
This is a major state university, so it's not. You know, it's not ideal, but it's still not the craziness that I'm hearing where the fall semester is already, you know, basically canceled other than online and things like that. Yeah. You know, and that's why it's so important to be honest about what's going on, even in these, you know, new hotspots that they're talking about in the Southwest. Or in Florida, where you live. I mean, it's important that people, you know, look, we should always be wary. Maybe something really will go awry. But right now, Sam, I can tell you that the only metric that counts in the end, which is COVID deaths. And again, putting aside the overcounting,
right.
We're still on the significant downslope of the curve.
Right.
And
the curve was only supposed to mitigate the curve. That was the whole plan. It was never reduced death ever.
Well, but right. But what I'm saying is that
originally
the final arbiter of the disease severity is deaths. And they're clearly going down. And there is a theoretical argument that the virus itself, which can happen, may have the variant that's out there now may have mutated slightly to something that actually is less lethal. That's possible. It could also be the effects of all the exposure and the increasing herd immunity.
Right.
And again, herd immunity doesn't have to be a perfect match. It doesn't have to be that, oh, yes, you develop this very large volume of very specific neutralizing antibodies. And, you know, the first whiff of the virus, you know, it's neutralized. No, it could be all these other responses that mitigate it and make it, you know, certainly not lethal and less likely to cause serious infection. And so a lot of that could be going on in the United States now. And it would be great if in fact the prevailing strains of the virus are now mutating in a more benign direction.
Well, So, okay. Dr. Bostom, straight from your mouth. Okay. What I'm hearing, the upshot is, they don't know, and yet they still pretend that they know better than we do. And that bothers me a lot.
It's I think it's a little worse than that. I think that they have a mindset that's locked in to only painting the worst case scenario.
Yeah, because of power. Anthony Fauci said, don't wear a mask, it's useless. Then he said, oh no, do wear a mask. Then he said, don't wear a mask. Now they're mandating that we wear masks.
Exactly. Well, Anthony Fauci also wrote an op-ed in the New England Journal.
Yes.
Where he
recanted.
he admitted that the case fatality ratio may actually turn out to be, 0.1%.
Right.
He admitted that it could fall in that range.
Right. But he also, go ahead.
And the CDC data basically, again, Sam, because remember, even the CDC's estimate of this,
they revised it down.
0.20 to 0.27%. That was assuming at maximum 50% of the infections were asymptomatic. Well, it could be 80%.
Exactly, and it looks like, and it actually looks that way. So
that really cuts it down. But again, I please remind your friends and your audience. Think about India. Think about India, whose Council of Medical Research, and India has some of the most brilliant physicians in the world, and a lot of them, I worked with a lot of Indian physicians, and they were outstanding clinicians, very bright people. And look, they could have a real catastrophe on their hands, but their infection fatality ratio is 0.08%. And so that's reassuring, includes deaths, Sam,
do we trust their number? How is their ratio so low?
I think a lot of it has to do with the preponderance of younger people. I mean, these are populations that we have an older population. This could turn out, coronavirus could turn out to be something where overall, the third world, the developing world, does better
So you trust their statistics?
I think they're perfectly reasonable. They're based on antibody testing. So they're at least trying to get a bigger handle on what the real denominator is.
I'd like to see how many tests they've done, like the number of tests and stuff. In fact, what is it? Worldometers has that data.
I wouldn't rely on them. They're not so good. I would trust the Indian Council of Medical Research more than them. But be that as it may, one of the things that we now know about COVID is that clearly it's almost Janus-based. It really attacks the elderly, and it's quite sparing of the young. So it's an ageist virus, and we need to banish it. It discriminates against the elderly.
It's terribly discriminatory.
It really is. And I think that may be what you see playing out in India, in Africa, et cetera, where, you're probably going to wind up seeing lower infection fatality ratios because they simply have younger population.
Right. Well, and who's in government? Old people. All right. Dr. Andrew Bostom, thank you so much for coming on the program.
People can go
to andrewbostom.org and see all the other stuff that he's up to. Please run for public office. I'll only ask you several times. I may at least
argue about my state's school policies.
You must do that. But you need also to consider running for, if not a public office, school board. We need people on school boards.
Dog catcher.
Don't make light. No. All right.
No.
Thanks for coming on the program. It's great to speak to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. So he took up all my time almost. Crazy. But sorry, I was fascinated. So I guess I'll get to the homeschool stuff. Let me play you this Tucker Carlson. It's off of Tucker Carlson. It's a clip of a woman, Tara Durant, who is in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and she makes a call to 911 because she's driving through an area that has rioters in it. And so he's going to play here the clip of her call to 911.
They're on my car, right? They're on my car right now.
But we would suggest you slowly drive through the area. Don't hit anyone with your vehicle.
I cannot get out of here, okay?
You have to be patient, but I'll let the officers know, okay?
But are you serious?
We can't do anything, ma'am. The city told us that this is a sanctioned event.
Get out of my car! This is going to get dangerous. I got a kid here.
Yes, ma'am. We would suggest that you call up City Hall to let them know about your frustrations, because we're all very frustrated.
Get out of the way! This is and I got a little girl in the car crying. Are you kidding me?
There you go. And the point is that she made a call to the police, and the police said, hey, we can't do anything because it is a sanctioned event, all bets are off. There is no law and order. Excuse me, what? Are you kidding me? No, that's the new norm, folks, is that if the government says there's no law and order, then there's no law and order. The police must stand down. And by the way, I don't believe that the police are into this. Like, I think that the police, they took an oath to protect and to serve. And I think they don't stand by willingly. Okay, the dispatcher notwithstanding. I don't know what her deal is, right? But they took an oath to protect and to serve, but there is a hierarchy and they serve on order. And if you have your governor or your mayor who says, you know what, police, you don't, no, you're not coming here. This is off limits to the police. Then they're leaving everybody in that community vulnerable. And by the way, they're actually broadcasting it. They're actually like making a major announcement. This is anarchy. This is anti-human. This is pro-fascism and communism. Now businesses in Seattle are suing the government for enabling the CHOP, the Capitol Hill, instead of autonomous zone, they're calling it the occupied protest. They actually call it Antifa Stan. So now businesses are suing the government. Well, who's the government, folks? We are. Who's paying for all of this? You are. I am. This was not the bargain that I made with my government when I paid my taxes. I did not say, here's some money, go give it to some lawless people, or don't protect me with it, but allow lawlessness to occur so that I have to sue to collect. And yet here we are. Why? Because we have elected individuals who have no accountability. Because we have raised individuals who have no accountability. Because we have raised individuals who don't understand accountability and responsibility. And then we ask them to be accountable and responsible, and they're not. But it all starts with school. Incidentally, the woman who called 911, that was in Fredericksburg, Virginia, the mayor, Greenlaw, issued a statement apologizing, not to the woman in the car, no, apologizing to the rioters. The leaders that we elected are now ignoring our suffering. I urge you to go and read the Declaration of Independence, because we are reaching slowly, we are reaching those times again. They're ignoring the suffering of the people who elected them. Or maybe they're not. Maybe they're counting on the votes of the Antifa activists. But in either case, they are ushering in a national crisis. And that crisis is that there are nefarious elements that are anti-American that wish for the destruction of Western society. What do I mean by that? What is Western society? Christian society, Judeo-Christian society built on the tenets of Judeo-Christianity, which are thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit murder, honor thy mother and father, the family, don't covet, don't lie. Those are the values that we hold in the United States, upon which we have built the greatest nation that the earth has ever known. And these people seek for its wholesale destruction, which starts with the removal of Trump. This is just the next step, the next phase. The first phase, Russia didn't work. The next phase, Ukraine didn't work. These people are domestic terrorists, and they need to be quashed. And as long as we sit in our homes and wear our masks, it's going to be very difficult to do that. So take that into the weekend. And also, get some Trump stickers and put them on rioters' cars while you're at it, because that's important, too. It's important to have some fun with these idiots. All right, that's my show for today. Thanks so much for listening. This is the Sam Sorbo Show. Please share with a friend. These are all podcasts. You can even find your favorite shows and listen.